CITR 101.9. This is the Ink Stud Show. I'm joined by my friend Colin Upton. Hello, Colin.
How do?
And on the phone we have Jeet here, classical comic expert. Is that a good phrase for you?
Yeah. Ink Stud student.
Ink Stud student. All right. I like that. From the School of Ink Stuttery.
That's right.
Today we're talking about Crazy Cat and George Harriman, breakthrough comic from the 10s, 20s, 30s, and 40s. What I just played was some of the music from the Crazy Cat silent movies. I doubt those were the original music from it, probably added on later, but courtesy.
But the spirit was right. I mean, they would have had sort of piano melodies, and I think they're pretty close, if they're not exactly the original.
Okay. There's courtesy of YouTube.com. If you want to check out the Crazy Cat cartoons, go to YouTube.com. This is CITR 101.9 FM from Vancouver. So, Jeet, George Harriman, let's talk a little bit of the man, the myth, the legend.
Sure.
So, what are some of his upbringings? Rumors circulate, and you did a little mini essay, I guess, in one of the Crazy Cats about his delineage.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think Harriman is interesting for all sorts of reasons. I mean, he's one of the really great cartoonists of the early 20th century and a huge influence on everyone from Walt Disney to Chris Ware. There's a sort of interesting controversy about his background, because when he died, he was sort of listed as being of French ancestry, and a couple of his cartoonist buddies, like Tad Dorgan, had said, thought he was Greek. They were actually called him the Greek because he sort of had tawny skin and didn't quite know what his ancestry was because he had a peculiar accent. And then many years after he died, a scholar was doing research into his life and came across his birth certificate. And it was from Louisiana, New Orleans, in 1880, where Harriman was born, and it said he was colored. And so that raised a kind of interesting question, because the term colored in American in the 19th century is a bit ambiguous. And sort of further research by myself and others kind of uncovered the fact that not only Harriman, but his entire family, like both his parents and his grandparents, were listed in the census and in their birth certificates as mulatto. And what I think my essay was trying to do was to kind of perhaps tie that in with his art, because obviously these sort of biographical details are only interesting to the extent that they shed light on his great art. And what's interesting about Harriman is that he really was born in this very unique American community of Creoles, of sort of people of mixed ancestry, people of, you know, who are partially of African origin, but who also have ancestors from Spain or from France, and who lived in New Orleans and in the Louisiana area. And what made Louisiana kind of interesting was that, unlike the rest of the South, they did have this unique community of Creole. People weren't just black and white. There was a recognized community of mulattoes who had their own sort of part of town and had their own cultural tradition, and in fact had their own kind of like language, which is a mixture of various Spanish and French and English. And so I think that kind of sheds a lot of light as to where Harriman is coming from, because I mean, one of the first things anyone will notice about Crazy Cat is the wonderful lingo. Crazy and all the other characters speak in like a variety of dialects, their language is filled with words taken from Spanish, from French, from Yiddish, and I think that Harriman's mixed ancestry is very much part of this, is rooted in his background in this sort of Creole community.
So it's kind of like an ethnic jambalaya.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, very much so, yeah. I mean, Louisiana and New Orleans is kind of interesting because it's like New York. It's not really part of America or the American mainstream. It's more a sort of Caribbean offshoot that happens to be a part of American territory. And, I mean, to this day, there's still sort of Cajuns in Louisiana that are more comfortable speaking French than English, and they've been there for, like, you know, 400 years.
So, do you think Harriman would have had a good reason not to talk about his past?
Well, there's clearly some sort of hiding going on, and I think we have to put it in the context of what's happening in his life, because he was born in the early 1880s, and around that time, Jim Crow really came on the rise. That's say, like, during the days of slavery, there's a clear demarcation between black and white in the South. Immediately afterwards, the Reconstruction, there's a lot of fluidity, and in the 1880s, there's a in part due to the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, there's a real attempt to create a solid line dividing black and white. And there were all these laws put in place defining who was black and who was white. And if you had even 1/16th black blood, you could be classified as a Negro, and therefore, you know, would suffer all the sort of penalties that Jim Crow had for blacks of not being able to vote and not being able to live in certain parts of town. And so what was happening when Harriman was growing up was that this sort of community that he grew up in, this Creole mixed community that had existed in a mixed state between black and white, was being squeezed out. And a lot of there's a sort of emigration of people like the Harriman family of Louisiana moving to places where they could more easily pass as white. So this wasn't just something that Harriman did. This was a sort of family decision. And we see it in the entire family that after the 1880s, they no longer ever refer to themselves as mulatto. In all the documents, they list themselves as white. And in Harriman's case, the sort of interesting thing about him is that he always wore a hat. In just about every photograph that we have of him, he's shown wearing a hat. And this is something his fellow cartoonist would make jokes about. And at least on one occasion, he explained to a friend that the reason he wore a hat was because his hair was kinky and because of his Negro blood. As he said, so Harriman obviously would have very good reason for wanting to be a little bit careful about his ethnicity, and that's why. And he was a bit of a player; like he liked to sort of take on different roles. So we have accounts of these Irish newsboys who were working, and they said, you know, when they started to talk to Harriman, he would adopt an Irish brog and try to convince them that he's Irish. And conversely, there are other occasions where he tried to pass himself as Greek or as French. So I think that the role playing was not just necessity in terms of not wanting to be discriminated against, but is also a part of his character, or that he was someone who really he liked to be able to put people on, you know. He liked to be able to he's a very playful man.
Would he have been published if his origins were more widely known?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, the only there were black cartoonists during his era, but they tended to be sort of segregated in the black press, and it was especially in the early decades of the century. It was only starting in the 1930s and 40s where you had some people like Sims, or later in the comic world, book world, people like Matt Barker, who were able to publish. Whereas, like when Harriman first started out, the newsrooms were very segregated, and there was really no room for either black cartoonists or black journalists. So I think that his his passing as white was partially due to simple economic necessity.
Now, he started in the comics or the comic strip field at a young age. Did he have any artistic training getting into it?
As far as we know, no. I mean, he really just kind of ran away from home and worked briefly drawing sort of circus posters. And but I think it was like by the time he was 19 or 20, he was starting to publish in both newspapers and in magazines like Puck and Judge. So I mean, I think that, but that's not atypical of his era. I mean, we think of great draftsmen like Winsor McCay, who had the sort of a brief training with a professor who taught him, you know, lessons for a few months. But really, Winsor McCay was also self-taught. So I think at that period, there really was not a lot of formal education available for cartoonists, and it was something that people learned on the job, as it were. And to some degree, that might have actually helped them a little bit, just in the sense that it, they're forced at a very early age to like produce a lot, and they were kind of learning from each other as well. Like if you look at the impact of Harriman and McKay and George McManus and the other cartoonists of the era, it's clear that what they were learning from was each other. If one cartoonist would do something spectacular, let's say in Little Nemo, George McManus would then do a fantasy strip of his own to try to match that. So I think that that's where the real education came from the fact that he, you know, when he was basically in his early 20s, he was, like, in the world of, like, New York City, and this is a time where there were, like, dozens of newspapers in the city, daily newspapers that were competing, and the big papers like Hearst and Pulitzer were spending a lot of money to try to get the attention of readers. And one way of getting readers was through comics. So he really was at the right place at the right time. I mean, to be a cartoonist in New York at the early 20th century would be like, you know, being in Hollywood in the 20s and 30s, you know, being a painter in Paris in the 20s. It was like, it was a very fertile and creative environment.
George McManus's Polly and Her Pals?
George McManus did Bringing Up Father.
Oh, Bringing Up Father.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Would Harriman also have been influenced by the other artistic painter movements that were happening at the time in New York?
This is something. It's a little bit hard to know on Harriman's specific case, but I think it's generally true that the cartoonists of that era were very attuned to the fine arts. And I think this can be seen actually in more easily in someone like Rudolph Dirks, who did the Katzenjammer Kids, who was a painter and would go to like Paris and also had shows at the Armory Show, which is the famous show that brought modern art to America. And it's pretty clear, that a lot of cartoonists, because of the Dirks connection, went to the Armory Show. That was like in 1913, and it kind of had a big influence on comics, because if you think about all the early comic strips of the of that era, the big sort of Sunday pages, a lot of them become very sort of freaky and surrealistic. But in some ways, I think Harriman might have actually had more of an influence on modern art rather than being influenced by it. What I mean to say by that is that I think that there were a lot of modern artists, preeminently Picasso, but also Joan Miron and Wilhelm de Kooning, who paid a great deal of attention to what Harriman was doing and incorporated elements of his work into what they were doing. As an example of what I'm saying, Harriman is often described as surrealistic, because he has this desert landscape that's always changing and shifting, and it's very psychedelic and dreamy. But the interesting thing is he was doing that long before the Surrealists came around, because Surrealism was really a movement of the 20s and 30s, and long before the term Surrealism was formed, Harriman was doing Surrealism. So I would kind of actually want to argue that rather than saying Harriman was influenced by modern art, to actually say that he influenced modern art. I don't know if that's too grand a claim.
With the grand scope of the amount of readership that he would have had at his prime, I don't think that would be a grandiose claim to make. The Hearst papers, what's a rough idea of circulation he would have had?
The New York American was one of the big American papers, so that would have been like hundreds of thousands just in New York City alone. And Hearst had papers all across the country, so his readership would have been like in the millions. And there were sort of, you know, references to Crazy Cat are like pervasive in early culture, 20th century culture. Like you see it being referred to everywhere, whether it's in, you know, James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake, there's a lot of references to Crazy Cat and sort of hurling of bricks, or in the correspondence of people like Edmund Wilson, the critic, or F. Scott Fitzgerald. I think he did have kind of a very large readership, especially in the early days. It kind of changed a little bit because I mean, one of the curiosities about Harriman is that as his work became more eccentric and more private, he lost a lot of his sort of fan base among the regular comic strip readers, and he really only continued to be published because William Randolph Hearst loved his work and would continue to pay him. And the, a lot of, in the 20s and 30s, a lot of newspaper readers would complain about Crazy Cat to the local editors, and they'd always be trying to kill the comic strip. But Hearst insisted that it was run. And I mean, another reason why Hearst would have insisted on this was that Crazy Cat was actually a sort of prestige item for the Hearst papers, because otherwise the Hearst papers were known for sort of sensationalism and crime story and lowbrow writing, but here they had a comic strip that was praised in Vanity Fair, you know, and was sort of turned into a ballet in 1922. So I think Crazy Cat did have quite a readership, and then there's all sorts of anecdotes that come across to express this, one of which is that during World War One, when Crazy Cat was running the papers, the Woodrow Wilson, the president Woodrow Wilson, would always turn to Crazy Cat first thing in reading a paper, and then read the war news. And this is a story that was told by Woodrow Wilson's secretary. So again, that kind of indicates how popular this was. And I think that's something that's very hard for us to understand now, because I mean, well, you know, things like graphic novels have a certain popularity and a certain cult audience. It's been a long time since comics have really been a mass form that had like a huge popular readership, you know, that included everyone from janitors to the president.
I think Colin just cried a little.
That could happen again, Colin.
Maybe very sad. I mean, well, they have these great big Sunday pages in color. It's like now the Sundays is like quarter of a page, and, mm-hmm. and the pages were larger then. They had so much room to breathe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the interesting things that's happening right now is when people are trying to reprint comic strips, there's a real move to try to recapture that sort of size and scope of it. I mean, I think one of the best books ever done in reprinting comics is the Little Nemo book that just came out last year.
Oh, the huge one?
Yeah, the huge book that reprinted, you know, it's the size of a full newspaper page. And it actually allowed you to see Nemo for the first time the way it was originally seen. And I'm working currently on a book with Chris Ware that will reprint the Gasoline Alley Sunday pages, mm-hmm. and it'll be the sort of the same format in terms of reprinting the comic strips in their original size.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and but it's that's of course their size. It's also that, you know, Pulitzer and Hearst, to get the readership, you know, hired the best engravers possible. So the engravers, so the color of these things is very different than what we're used to in newspapers. It's not flat, broad colors. It's very textured and detailed, and very nuanced and subtle. So if you look at like sort of, you know, Gasoline Alley or Crazy Cat or Little Nemo, it's clear that, you know, a lot of attention, loving attention, has been given to capturing just the right mood with color. And that's something that comics lost for a long time, I think, as they were more crudely printed. But it's also something I think that they're kind of regaining. I mean, I don't think it's an accident that, you know, Chris Ware, who is, you know, so talented in his use of colors, is attracted to these early comic strips, or someone like Seth as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, with Chris mm-hmm. Ware, it's so, you can just see it, just that he wears on his sleeve with Quimby.
Yeah.
I mean, his first, I guess, big epic, mm-hmm. in a way, just politely reeks of Crazy Cat in an homage,
yeah.
kind of way, taking it to his own level
but,
of...
But these things are not being done in newspapers any longer.
Yeah.
Well, New York Times? Doing the Sunday special editions with the Chris Ware's The Building, and right now Jaime Hernandez with was it La Vida Locus?
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, there is, I think that there is
a small resurgence.
Yeah, a small resurgence, yeah. And I think that it's, I mean, we shouldn't be too hung up on the newspaper format, because it's the content that's important, right? The format serves the content. And if the newspapers are no longer the best form for comics, then they'll move on to something else, whether it's comic books or the graphic novel. So what I think is more important is that a lot of young cartoonists today are very much trying to recapture the sort of aesthetic sensibility of the early 20th century. And in some ways, I mean, I think Harriman almost has, like, a larger readership now than he did, like, when he died. Because, as I mentioned earlier, when he, in his last few years, the strip was appearing in fewer papers, and it was getting harder and harder for Hearst to keep it in his own papers. Whereas now, because there's such a vibrant scene of people that are interested in art comics, a lot of young cartoonists are looking at Crazy Cat as a precursor and as something to study and to look at. And I think that that's one of the purposes that the sort of reprinting of Crazy Cat or the reprinting of Peanuts or Gasolinelli will serve. It's not just a nostalgic interest. It's not just an antiquarian or historical interest. You know, let's put all these comic books in book form for the library. This is actually something that is the sort of seedbed for the future of the art. I think virtually any interesting young cartoonist is someone who is looking back to the past and is trying to, you know, learn what he or she can from George Harriman or Winsor McCay or Frank King.
Okay, I'm going to take a quick, I want to pick up on this more.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a quick musical break and
sure.
a station ID break. This is CITR 101.9. We have Jeet here. Did I pronounce your name properly?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, excellent. And we're talking about Crazy Cat, George Harriman, and I guess some of the effect on comics nowadays with the resurgence of collections and good stuff like that coming from Fantagraphics on Quarterly. So we'll be back, Inkstuds.
Obscura promo, take one.
Hey Lloyd, I'm ready to be heartbroken.
Next.
Hey Lloyd, I'm ready to be heartbroken.
Next.
Hey Lloyd, I'm ready to be heartbroken, old baby.
Next.
There's a reason why Camera Obscura are the ones doing the touring. Sealed with a Kiss presents Glasgow's Camera Obscura, with guests shapes and sizes, Monday, July 24th at the Plaza, doors at 8. Tickets available at Red Cat, Zulu, and Scratch.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Ink Stud Show, where we talk about comics. It's about 2:30-ish. We're joined by Jeet here, and we're talking about Crazy Cat and George Harriman and all the wacky good times fun. Colin has an on-air confession to make. Lifelong comic artist Colin Upton, mini comics creator extraordinaire.
Comics scholar.
Curmudgeon.
Mm-hmm. Curmudgeon, yeah. Well, I know this is going to get me, I'm going to lose the respect of everybody listening, but I have to confess that after years of looking at Crazy Cat, I'm not sure I quite get it. What makes it so great? It's this mouse, the cat loves the mouse, but the mouse hates the cat and throws bricks at the cat, and the dog loves the mouse, but loves the cat. I'm just not sure if I get what other people do from it. So I was wondering if you could explain to me what makes it so special.
Sure. First of all, you shouldn't apologize for not getting it. I mean, I think there are, you belong to a select company, but there are others. I think Jules Pfeiffer also made the same confession. As did Chester Brown. So I think you're in good company. I think for those of us who do get Crazy Cat, and I think that's a good way of putting it, it's something you get or you don't get. It's like a radio frequency that some of us are attuned to and others aren't. And I think for myself, what is great is not so much the plot line, which is, as you said, very rudimentary. It's a love triangle of... but a very skewed one, with the cat loving the mouse, and the mouse hitting the cat, and the dog loving the cat, and the cat being indifferent to the dog. What's great, as in so many other early 20th century comic strips, is the endless variations that can be run on it, and also, as I mentioned earlier, the sort of language that Harriman had, where Crazy has her own sort of dialect, and it's very it's something you can kind of, it has this great sing-song charm that you can read along to it, and the real sense of playfulness that he gets, which I think is very rare in art. I mean, I think most works of art somehow seem to be related to life in the world, and it's a very rare artist that can create a whole imaginary realm that's has its own organic wholeness. I mean, somebody comparable would be Lewis Carroll with Alice in Wonderland, where the world of Alice in Wonderland doesn't make much sense, but it seems to have its own internal logic and its own sort of playful spirit. Aside from that, I mean, I think there's the art, which is a very important part of it. And there's two elements of the art. One is his great sense of characterization. I mean, the figures are very small. They're almost like little squat bugs, you know. If you take a bug and you smash it with your thumb, it looks a little bit about the size of Ignatz the mouse. But despite their smallness, they're very limber. The characters have their own way of walking and talking, so that, you know, Crazy sort of saunters along in an ambling pace, whereas Ignaz is very intent on throwing the brick. And even when the little mouse heaves the brick, you can kind of almost feel his shoulder blades kind of, you know, exerting their energy. Whereas the Officer Pup, the dog, he walks with a sort of grim determination of the law that wants to enforce its will. So the characters are great. They all have, and these are the three major characters with this huge cast behind them. They all have their own identity. And the final element is a sense of page design, that the Sunday pages that Harriman had were organized as an organic whole. They weren't like little blocks. You had little, the panels were there, but if you look at each page from a distance, it's almost like a painting where he's clearly thinking about the composition of the whole page. And I think that that's something that's quite appealing. One other element I'd kind of add is the sort of the sense of the American desert, which is very important. In the early 20th century, this was the first time where the sort of Grand Canyon had been opened up to visitors and tourism, because in the 19th century it was quite inaccessible. And Harriman was, because William Randolph Hearst had a sort of a lodge near the Grand Canyon, Harriman and his other cartoonist buddies like Jimmy Swimmerton and Rudolph Dirks and Frank King would all be hanging around the Grand Canyon. And Harriman was really drawn to this place, so the sort of the vastness of the desert, the shifting landscape, the way that it sort of, unlike the sort of traditional European landscape, it was very overwhelming. Like the landscape that we're used to from paintings is sort of enclosed within the painting, whereas the Grand Canyon can't be enclosed in that way. It's sort of larger than everything else around it. And Harriman really captured that in his in The Art and Crazy Cat. It's one of the first attempts to like to bring into art this phenomenon that European eyes weren't used to, of a desert landscape that's almost like the moon, that has its own sort of surrealistic quality and it's sort of overpowering. And even though he's only working in a sort of comic strip and had these daily deadlines, Harriman like was, I think, one of the first artists to make the American desert a part of art. Does that help?
Do you feel edumacated, Colin?
Yes, well, I certainly recognize the incredible inventiveness of the page design and the storytelling techniques. I'm just amazed that he had this one theme going over, what, three decades?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's the... the repetitive quality comes partially from the sort of like vaudeville, which is very much a part of what he was sort of growing up with. You know, he's like in New York in the teens, and like a lot of cartoonists, he'd be part of the sort of what was known as a sporting life, you know, going to boxing matches and going to vaudeville. And the early Crazy Cat has this sort of, it feels like a Burt Williams routine from the early part of the 20th century. But I think it's also, he was very much, he tapped into something, which is the sort of repetitive nature of both life and the comic strip. The comic strip is very interesting. It's a daily art form. You know, it appears every day, and I think it's the first daily art form, because prior to that, I mean, people like Dickens wrote serialized novels, but they appeared every week or every month. Whereas a comic strip was appearing every day, and it's sort of a part of the fabric of daily life. You know, people used it as part of their routine. They would read a comic strip, bring breakfast, and chuckle over it, and talk to their friends about it. Or if they liked something, they would, you know, stick it on the fridge. So it's not like a painting where, you know, you have to make a special effort to go to the museum. And so part of dailiness is repetition, because a lot of what we do in daily life is, you know, what we did yesterday. You know, like brushing our teeth, breakfast, going to the toilet. And so I think for a comic strip artist, routine or regularity is really important. And the one artist that really picked up on that after Harriman was Schultz with Peanuts. Because, I mean, admittedly, Peanuts had more than just one joke. But if you think about it, it had maybe like 10 or 12 jokes. You know, there's Lucy pulling the football. There was Charlie Brown's baseball team losing. There was Lucy being the psychiatrist and giving bad advice. There's the Great Pumpkin. And I think what Schultz realized, and because Schultz was a huge fan of Harriman, was that it's this daily... a cartoonist draws strength from routine, from familiarity. The comic strip characters become a part of everyday life because they're doing the same thing over and over again. And I for me, that's part of, that's not a weakness in Harriman. That's actually a part of his strength, that he realized that, you know, the more you have the characters doing something similar with variations, the more they seem like real people.
Now, there's a lot of new collections out of Crazy Cats, and going through it, do you see that with the creation of it, it was something that he did that should be read not all at once, but like a page at a day?
Yeah, that's something else worth mentioning. And actually, my girlfriend had talked about this with me once. I was saying how she really likes to sort of keep one of these books by her the bedstand and read, like, you know, a page or two every night, and then rather than read it like a novel where you race through it. And I think the strips kind of benefit from that sort of a more spread out pace, because that's partially how they were meant to be read, and also that ties in with the dailiness that I was trying to get at. If they're somehow part of your routine life, they become more powerful. I think the other thing to mention about the comic strip is that I think a lot of these were meant to be read more than once. That's to say, you can read the comic strip once for the joke, but then you can sort of set aside and then look at the composition of the page, and then often you can go back and reread it and get something more out of it. I think that's true, like, of all the sort of best of the early comic strips, certainly of Gastinelli and Little Nemo as well, that they kind of were really meant for repeated reading, and for sort of, you know, whereas contemporary comic strips, I mean, they're all about the gag, right? You have to get to the last panel and you get the gag and you can put it aside. And whereas these, I mean, the early comic strips, they're more about the ride rather than the destination, if that makes any sense.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah.
I think one thing important for people to understand is that part of the timeless aspect, I think, of Crazy Cat is it's the first, to me, it's the first cat and mouse duo to be repeated often. So we're talking about repeating the same joke, but it's also repeated by Tom and Jerry, Itchy and Scratchy.
That's right, yeah.
And it's also the same joke in all aspects, too.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I'm not sure if someone did the more scholarly analysis, they could probably find maybe there was someone before Harriman that's doing a cat and mouse, but I actually can't think of anyone. Unless he was, I mean, I know he's probably drawing from sort of the sort of black folklore that gave us Brer Rabbit, right? Like the sort of, and there's a sort of tradition of animal stories going back to Aesop. But certainly the sort of dynamic that he laid out of the cat and mouse is very, I think he is a huge figure in creating that and popularizing it. And I actually think that that's also, it ties in with the kind of racial aspect again as well, because if you look at the stories of Brer Rabbit or other sort of folk stories that came out of the American South, often animals were associated with different races. So there's a tradition of associating blacks with mice or with frogs. So I think that's very interesting. And then the artist who really picked up on that contemporary was Art Spiegelman, where in Mouse he's took the sort of latent racial potential of the cat-mouse dynamic and used it to tell a story about Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm. It's, yeah. I didn't even think about that one. I should have. One thing I want to try and cover is some of Harriman's pre-Crazy Cat work. Because, I mean, Crazy Cat, obviously, a huge body of work. Currently, Fantagraphics has 7 volumes out, I think.
That's right, there's 7 volumes, and ultimately there'll probably be about 15 volumes of the Sunday Pages, but yeah.
They started out, the first book, I think, was the, what was it, the 25, 26? Or 20,
that's right, yeah.
The 1925, or 26, 27. Mm-hmm. No, 25, 26,
no,
I don't know.
No, 25, 26, yeah.
Okay, I gotta stack them here.
We mostly know about the Sundays because that's what gets reprinted, but yeah. He also was doing a daily strip at the same time?
He was doing a daily strip, and that's been reprinted, but much more in a scattershot fashion by a bunch of small publishers. If any of your listeners really want to like go into the sort of the deeper reaches of Harrimania, you can go into Pacific Press or Stinging Monkey, and these are sort of, you know, they're so small that they make Fantagraphics look like Simon and Schuster. So some of the dailies have been reprinted, but not enough. And actually, I don't know if I'm letting out any secrets, but I think Fantagraphics does plan on doing at least one book of the dailies and perhaps more. So, and the daily strips have their own kind of rhythm and charm, which is a bit different from the Sunday pages. They're much more sort of in the tradition of vaudeville, and they're much more about a kind of verbal humor.
They read completely differently. I was looking at some of the daily. I have the comic art of George Harriman Crazy Cat book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even remember who wrote that, but there's a lot of stuff mm-hmm. in it.
Oh, well, that was partially you know who wrote that. He's a famous cartoonist now. It's Patrick McDonald, who does Mutts.
That explains
does
something.
Which
Mutts.
The strip called Mutts.
Oh, okay, Mutts.
Patrick McDonald and his wife Karen. They did that book. Yeah, and they.
That explains a lot about Mutts.
Yeah.
One thing I noticed as Colin was flipping through, we're looking at is, and I never thought about this, is Crazy Cat isn't very political, but in this there's a thing about the Kaiser.
Yes.
From 1916. Is that kind of his own little... Do you know anything about Harriman avoiding doing politics in the comic strip, or...
That's an interesting sort of question. I mean, Harriman did have politics. I mean, he was... basically a sort of almost a vegetarian. He had to eat a little bit of meat because for health reasons. He didn't know how to get protein otherwise, but he's a pacifist. He would only buy Ford cars because Ford had objected to the First World War and wouldn't like make armaments in his industry during the First World War. So Harriman definitely had a sort of politics. I mean, in the comic strip, I think the politics comes through, but in different ways. One is that there's a sort of constant mockery of aristocrats and of royalty and snobbery. And this, I mean, that's a very old American tradition, because America's, you know, the Great Republic. And going back to Mark Twain and earlier, they love to make fun of dukes and kings. And there's quite a bit of that in Crazy Cat. And a sort of general, I would say, almost populist spirit. And the other issue is sort of prohibition, which comes through in a lot of funny ways in Crazy Cat. With there's a sort of catnip is often used as a sort of code word for drinking, and this is a sort of funny sequence where a bunch of dogs want to create blue laws to ban drinking in Coconino County, and they sort of run out of town. So in terms of the other politics or political issue is kind of sort of like drugs and psychedelia, because there's a character, a dog named Marijuana, who's a Mexican dog, and there's a sort of little thing called Tiger Tea that makes everyone very wild and turns the tamest cat into a tiger. Harriman was definitely kind of part of the sort of incipient drug culture of the 20s and 30s in Hollywood. I think that sort of perhaps would give some indication of where he's coming from. He's certainly very different than someone like someone like Harold Gray, who did Little Orphan Annie, where the politics are very front and center. I mean, you know, in Orphan Annie, it's very clear that he hates labor unions, he hates liberals, he hates professors, and he especially hates Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. So.
Now, is that one of the aspects that maybe made Crazy Cat different from other, was Harriman's his recreational use
I don't know if that would distinguish him from other cartoonists, because...
Well, I just mean in the formation of the style, because
at his... the thing is, like, all these early 20th century cartoonists, as far as I can tell, I mean, they're all kind of pretty heavy drinkers. And there is probably a generational thing, like, the sort of... especially the sort of men who are, like, you know, working in newspapers and, you know, is a very sort of masculine world of tough guys and of going out on the town. And so I think that perhaps what distinguishes Harriman is that he brought more of his inner life into the comic strip page. You know, like, I think a lot of the early cartoonists were just in it for the jokes or the yucks or, you know, making fun of things. And whereas with Crazy Cat, it seems like a very personal work. I mean, that's one reason why I think it's very contemporary. It reads very much like the sort of work of the era of Chester Brown or of the era of Chris Ware. Like, it's he's clearly, like, you know, Crazy and Ignatz mean a lot to him, and there's a lot of sort of personal issues that show up in the comic strip.
Yeah, I get this impression from, I don't know, people like Seagar and the early cartoonists. They seemed like a pretty aggressive bunch. I mean, wasn't Harriman, didn't Harriman, like, beat up a guy at a train station or something?
I don't know if that was Harriman. That might have been Winsor McKay.
Winsor McKay?
Yeah. Well, there's this thing where some guy was claiming that he was having an affair with McKay's wife, and he almost beat him up, I think. And but yeah, they're real. They're newspaper men, right? Like, they're of the era of, you know, the front page and of, you know, like, sort of wisecracking Humphrey Bogart like tough guys, you know, hanging around the newsroom, drinking, smoking,
even the cartoonists,
skirt chasing. So I mean, they're very different than what one would associate with cartoonists today.
Yeah, we had Spain on. I guess you'd listen to that one, and I was like, he's the only cartoonist I know that gets in a fight.
So, I mean, and very much into boxing. I mean, that's the thing, though. There are sort of pictures of McKay lived next to one of the top boxers of the time, and all these guys would go out and see, you know, Jack Jackson and the other big boxing matches, and he's very much a part of the milieu of.
Yes, it's the L.A. culture.
I think the best term for it is a sort of one that Chris Ware uses, which is, it's the sporting life, you know? Mm. It's the life of being, you know, a good sport, a guy's guy. But, I mean, Harriman, I also have a sense that he kind of underwent changes. I mean, that's very much his life in the teens and in the first 20 years of cartooning. But starting in the 20s, he and his family moved back to Los Angeles, and he had a home in the Hollywood Hills. And he seemed to have become much shyer and more retiring at that point. And at that, his friends were more than in the sort of art world or in film. So he would hang around the lots where they were making the Keystone Cop comedies, and he knew Frank Capra. And I believe he knew John Ford as well. So he kind of moved from the newspaper world to the more sort of L.A. Film cultural world. And his son-in-law was a screenwriter and wrote the screenplay for The Hound of Baskerville, the Sherlock Holmes movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now, his later life was pretty tragic.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. His wife died in a car accident in 1931. They actually have the wrong date in that Crazy Cat book, by the way. They have 34. And then later in the decade, his daughter died. One of his two daughters died very young as well, at the age of around 30. So there's a fair bit of sort of loneliness in his life for those reasons.
And he kind of, one thing is, he had a lot of pets, and he kind of made his home, like, painted it and gave it that Crazy Cat aspect to it, I guess?
That's right, yeah. He had a home in the sort of Hollywood Hills, and he, there's a lot of sort of decoration, and there's a number of people that have made sort of pilgrimages there. One was David Collier and Pat Moriarty. They went there without telling the current owner that they were going there. they were like, you know, sort of casing the house, and it had a sort of high wall, and then the owner came out in his bathrobe and said, "What the hell are you two guys doing there?" And Collier, with his great sort of self-confidence, said, "Hey, man, this is Harriman's house."
There should be a plaque.
And more recently, Chris Ware and another friend, Tim Samuelson, made a pilgrimage there as well. So I think this will be like a shrine to cartoonist, like the place in Paris where that heals the sick.
It's like the
Lourdes.
The Lourdes, yeah, that's right, yeah.
The comic book Holy Land.
Yeah.
Wow, I just wondering what the owner of the house would think.
Yeah.
Who are these really nerdy guys coming to my house?
That's right, yeah.
Well, thank you, Jeet. I think we're nearing the end of our time.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going to cover some local Vancouver news. And so that was Crazy Cat. We're talking about George Harriman. And if you want to check out Crazy Cat books, Fantagraphics has a lot, has 7 books so far. And you've got, how many of the Crazy Cat books do you have intros in? Just one of them, or?
Oh, me?
Yeah.
Oh, I have about 26 or 27 Crazy Cat books.
No, how many have you written introductions for?
Oh, I only wrote an introduction to one volume so far, which is 35, 36. But I'm going to write an introduction to a subsequent volume as well. And, yeah, I'm also working on the series Walton Skizik for Drawn and Quarterly.
Mm-hmm. And the second volume of that's supposed to be coming out.
That's right. That'll be
one day.
In the next couple of weeks, yeah.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
I know some people will be very happy. Mm-hmm. They've been telling me I need to read it. And one day I will. So thank you, Jeet.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Robin and Colin. It was really fun talking to you guys.
Totally. It was great. And I learned a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Me too.
Thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.
Jeet here, comic expert. He's doing his doctorate on, I think it was at Little Lulu.
Wow.
Should have asked him a little bit about that. It's pretty neat stuff.
Oh, maybe another time.
Google his name, JEETHEER, and you will learn some stuff about him. Over the next month, we have a fair amount of some pretty dope shows. Word. Dope, good.
Oh, dope, good.
Yeah, sorry, I gotta speak in colonies. I'll use some fancy Victorian terms.
Yeah, just think of me as your old Uncle Colin who doesn't understand much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Colin does understand. He just pretends he doesn't. So next week, we are going to be joined by Gareth Gordon. Gordon?
Gowden.
I apologize, Gareth, if you're listening. He is doing.
I may be wrong, but
he's doing a comic every day for the rest of his life.
He's
not
crazy.
Monday to Friday, every day. Saturday, Sunday. He owns Legends Comics in Victoria, my favorite comic store in Victoria, right next to my favorite record store in Victoria, Titch Records. If you're going to Victoria, go to Legends, and you will find a million comics by Gareth. The whole display at the front counter is
How long has he been doing this so far?
Obviously a million days.
A million days. This will be the 2-year anniversary when we have him on.
Cool.
So that's, or within a week of the 2-year anniversary. So it's kind of, I think the 2-year anniversary is like 22nd or something.
Hmm.
So, but you know, it's commendable. It's interesting. It's actually really neat stuff. I'm really surprised, you know, if someone is able to do a really neat comic every day. If you read the Iron Man online challenge of these guys doing comics Monday to Friday, a lot of them are pretty weak.
Monday to Friday.
Yeah, that was Gareth's response. Whatever, they get the weekends off. Boo to weekends. And the week after that, I've been joined by Abby Denson, who is the creator of High School Confidential. She is going to be in town on the 3rd to do a signing at Sophia's Books. Go down, check it out. It's a really neat book. It's about a young man coming out of the closet in high school, and if anyone knows anything about that, it ain't easy. So it's a really neat book. I think we'll be doing a giveaway of that book either that week or next week. Week after that, I'm not sure yet. I'm not sure. August 10th.
You said we were booked.
We are booked, but I've got a couple of things on the go that I've got to figure out what it's going to be. Might be Jonathan Bennett. I've got to hook up with him and do an interview with him. He is my favorite creator in MOM, which is saying a lot because there's some excellent creators in MOM. Really personal stories, just strong, incredible stuff. And then after that, on the 17th, we will be joined by James Kolchelka, superstar.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Keep your pants on.
I've seen his penis.
Thank you, Colin.
I have.
I know. You keep telling us. That makes me awkward. 24th, we'll be joined by Sean from Sophia's Books. We'll be joining me to interview James Jean. cover artist of Fables. Colin's looking at me whimsically, unsure what I'm saying.
Bemused.
Okay, whatever. Yeah. He's a great stuff. Check it out, jamesjean.com, jameskolchelka.com. Don't forget our Inkstuds podcast, www.crowncommission.com/inkstuds. And I think eventually we're going to have podcasting on here at CITR. I've got to write a write-up, and they all gave me a hard time today, so I better get it done this weekend. And the week after that, August 31st, will be Robin Thompson, local creator of Champions of Hell and Zombie Jesus and other stuff. He likes to rock. His own personal demeanor does not suit his comics. You look at his comics, you think it's going to be like Glenn Danzig, and my friend, he's not Glenn Danzig.
Well, he does stand-up comedy, doesn't he?
Robin Thompson?
Doesn't he?
You're thinking of Ian Boothby.
Well, I think Robin also does comedy.
He does comics.
And
there's a difference between comics and comedy, Colin.
I'm aware of that, Robin.
I know. I don't know. We'll ask him. We will ask him. August 31st. In September, Joe Sacco, Chester Brown... and a bunch of others. I really want
to
interview Anders Nilsson.
Roberta Gregory.
Roberta Gregory, she's coming out of town for the VCon, so hopefully while she's up in town, we can meet up with her and yak with her. She's the creator of Naughty Bits, breakthrough feminist comic from Fantagraphics, ended last year, I think, with issue 41. Be interesting to talk to her. She's got a lot of history and a wide repertoire of comics. Inkstuds, CHR 101.9, will be followed up by Rhymes and Reasons. Word.
Reggae, reggae, rap, reggae, rap, Tupac, Biggie, everything.